morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for Wednesday morning call and talk radio here on Cebu Community Radio, where the time is 24 minutes before 8 o'clock. And the number to call to join in the conversation this morning is 503-231-8187. Well, this Sunday we're going to be marking, I would hardly say celebrating, the third anniversary of the war in Iraq. And it's going to be to mark that and to hopefully end the war, a large march and rally in Portland. I think this is tied in with national events and probably international events going on. And I have two guests with me this morning. We're going to be talking about the upcoming rally and march, why it's important to continue to protest against the war, and a little bit more about what this war is about in case it's become background noise in your life. We want to kind of bring it back into the foreground. And so I'm joined right now by Kelly Campbell, who is with the American Friends Service Committee, and also she's also involved with the September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrow. She's a founding member of that group, as well as Katie Heald, who is with Code Pink Portland. And they're both involved with organizing the march. And in about a little over 20 minutes, we're going to be joined by Iman Ahmad Kamas, who's an Iraqi journalist, translator, and activist. And she'll be giving an Iraqi woman's perspective on what's going on. So good morning, Kelly and Katie.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So let's first talk a little bit about, I opened the paper today and what I saw is that reprisals are starting to escalate. They keep saying that Iraq is on the verge of civil war, and it seems like instead of saying that every week, it incrementally increases so that there's a new stage that we're like one step away from, like we're half of a whatever from civil war, and then it's a quarter and it's an eighth, and we keep like having that distance. We're not quite ready to commit that Iraq is having a civil war. And then I heard a rather startling announcement by George Bush, who said that it's Iran's fault. And I guess mm-hmm. that's the new subterfuge for why we're going to go to war with Iran. And I guess after a while, he'll also try to say it's Hugo Chavez's fault and we'll be going to war with Venezuela. So let's talk about how we can stop that by getting out and marching on Sunday.
Well, I think it's really important for all of us to come out and be in the streets every once in a while and really show that the majority of people in this country are against the war in Iraq. The vast majority of people in the world are against this war. More than 80% of the people in Iraq want the U.S. troops out now. And we who believe this war is wrong have a responsibility to be out there, to be doing what we can. So we are going to be marching on Sunday in Portland. There are hundreds of other marches planned this weekend around the country, others around the world. And there's a whole week of events going on in Portland right now. It's not just Sunday. But Monday, the day after that, we'll have a whole evening with Iman, who's visiting us from Baghdad, and really get to hear, like you said, an Iraqi woman's perspective, someone who's traveled here from Baghdad who can talk to us about what she thinks about are they at civil war, are they at quarter civil war, what's the real situation on the ground. So I'm excited that we're going to be able to have a chance to do that here in Portland, to really hear directly from a woman who's living in Baghdad, who understands the situation much better than any of us can.
Well, before we talk about the specifics about the march, I'm kind of interested in talking about why we should march. I was having a conversation with my nephew, who gives me always very interesting perspectives, and he was saying, well, people just don't have the same energy about and the same level of politicization about the war that they had 3 years ago, and you know, people aren't going out in the streets anymore, and if we have a rally, we're not going to get the 40, 50,000 people that we had out in the streets 3 years ago. So why is it important that people get out in the streets, and are you a little more optimistic that perhaps there will be more people this week than there have been in the last couple of years marching against the war?
I think there will be. Instead of people being less politicized, I think we're actually at the turning point, because there have been polls. There was an AP poll last week that said that 58% of Americans think that the Iraq war is being handled badly, and there was 72% of service people want to be out of Iraq within the year before the end of 2006. I mean, I think actually people's opinions are changing about this, and they are becoming aware that this is wrong, and I think that will actually bring people out. And the other thing about this national movement that's going on right now is it's not just about marching anymore, and it's there, I think marches have their own importance, but it's also about a comprehensive plan. I mean, we're also doing, on Friday, we have lobbying visits. On Friday and Thursday, we have lobbying visits with all of the representatives and senators in Oregon around the state. People are going to their offices and visiting with them and making it clear that you'll see this weekend how many people are going to come out and talk and show that they're against this war. So you need to do something right now. And we're also, there's also civil resistance actions planned this weekend across the country to disrupt business as usual. And so it's about, you know, getting them from all different angles, but having those numbers out in the streets gives those small groups of people a lot more leverage to push their other programs through and make their point.
Well, actually, this is a little bit off the wall. I guess I was in a land that's even further removed from reality than Portland. Last week I was in San Francisco, and while I was there, I read the news. Actually, I think that was an email I got from Dan Flessis here at KBOO, that by a 7-3 margin, the San Francisco City Council had voted to impeach George W. Bush. I mean, I wish that they had the effect of actually doing it.
Right.
But I thought that's an interesting move for a city council to take, that we're voting to impeach the president of the United States. Now, are there actions that, like, our Portland City Council can take? Maybe we should be voting to impeach Bush as well, but it's particularly about the war. I mean, I know that, was it 2 years ago, there was a very contentious struggle within the city council to vote basically to censure the war in Iraq, and it didn't happen. But do you think that that's an important move to make, to have municipal and state political bodies coming out against the war in very forceful ways and actually getting city council people to be at the march on, I remember 3 years ago, a number of city council people were at the march, marches before the war started. So are we trying to get that kind of mainstream presence at the march as well?
I think it is important. One thing that AFSC is exploring doing is looking at a city council resolution against the war in Iraq that also brings in the idea of how much money we are spending on this war and how that money could be so much better spent here in Portland. And especially when you open the papers every day and see, you know, we're 50-some million short for schools, and then you look at how much money we're spending on this war, I think it's, you know, doing things like city council resolutions, yes, the city council can't actually impeach Bush or can't actually stop the war, but it can send a message that the people of this city want certain things. And I think that is the responsibility of the city council. So that's something that we're looking at doing, is looking at the war in Iraq, looking at a city council resolution, and seeing if that's a way to go here. There are, I think, about 75 cities across the country that have passed resolutions since the war started. And they're not just the usual suspects. It's not just San Francisco and Berkeley.
And actually, Portland is not one of them.
Right.
But Multnomah County voted.
Exactly. Yes. That was before the war. But these are just since the war started, where it's actually been more difficult to get city council resolutions passed. But Chicago, Baltimore, Sacramento, some cities that you wouldn't necessarily expect have come out with really strong resolutions. And I think it does kind of help build this movement. And again, you know, it's not just always about being in the streets, but being in the streets, you can collect these signatures. Being in the streets, you can ask the city council people to come out and be with you. So that's why actions like Sunday are so important, is for us all to come together and start saying, we're against this war, we're going to be in the streets, we're going to be doing other things, we're going to be lobbying, we're going to be talking to city council, we're going to be talking to the media, we're going to be talking to our churches and our synagogues, and we're going to be changing the way that this country works.
Well, I actually, for somebody who's been in the streets since I was 18, I think it's a really good thing to do. I think it's also important for people that are going to be my age. I mean, I don't want to be in the streets every day like I was in 1991 during the Persian Gulf War. I mean, I was in the streets there for a while and maybe got a little too self-righteous about, you know, what are you doing if you're not on the streets? Because I think you burn people out being in the streets too much. Now, we haven't had a big rally in a while. Maybe, I'm trying to think of when the last anti-war march and rally was, possibly a year since there's been a really major one. But I mean, there's been a lot of smaller actions, but like trying to have a mass mobilization, which is what I consider this.
There were mobilizations in September, but yeah, it wasn't a huge rally here. It was candlelight vigils and things like that.
Right. And so the idea of having the raising the energy, I think, is really great. And for people to get out in the streets and see that there's other people who agree with them. And I mean, I was in this big march in Caracas at the Takeoff for the World Social Forum, and there were about, you know, 50,000 people at that march probably. And it was really exciting, and it's also great to march with people from all over the Americas. So it added a certain energy level, but it reminded me, you know, taking a long walk with a lot of people and chanting and being focused that this is not all what politics is, but it gives you that kind of charge that we can then do the stuff that isn't quite as exciting, like the lobbying.
Right.
So first I want to talk a little bit about what people can expect at the march and rally on Sunday, and then we'll talk some more about the events leading up to and then after that. So, first of all, where should people go and what time should they be there?
People should go to Waterfront Park at 1:30, just north of the Morrison Bridge, and there's some construction. So Oak Street is the best place to enter Waterfront Park right now. But 1:30, start gathering in the park. There will be some music on the stage from 1:30 to 2 and some community singing, getting the whole crowd singing songs together that we all know, which will be really amazing. And one of the groups that's going to be on stage at the beginning is a group that's going to be fronted by Marilyn Keller. So it's going to be some really amazing music. And then about 2 o'clock, the speakers will start. And it'll just be from 2 to 2:30. There will be speakers. We're keeping it short and sweet this year, keeping people moving. And then at 2:30, we're going to start a march that's going to go through downtown Portland. And, of course, people can stay in the park if they don't feel like they can march. But there'll be a march that will loop through downtown Portland and then enter back into the park. And then there will be a few more speakers at the end if people want to stay and hear some more speaking and have some more discussion, too. And then we're going to be wrapping things up by, like, 4:15.
So we were saying before we went on the air that there was a discussion about not having too many issues, the sub-issue people.
Right.
So let's talk a little about those sub-issue people. I was joking with Kelly about how the United for Peace marches in Washington, in New York in particular, are notorious for having like 50 different issues that people address. They go on and on and on and on and on. It reminds me of the old programming on WBAI in the 70s that were the half-hour rants, and you know, from every perspective you could imagine that wasn't on mainstream media. So I take it it's not going to be like that.
Not quite like that. Well, we did kind of as a group some of the organizations that are involved in this, and there are 150 different organizations that have signed on at this point to come together and support this.
So they're not all
going to
have speakers, right?
They're not all going to have speakers. We limited it to 5 kind of topics, and then limited it to about 5 speakers. I think Kelly has the sub-themes over there.
I will just interject that I went to a rally once. It was just before the vote in 92 for the anti-gay initiative Measure 9. Mm-hmm. And it was organized by people of Faith Against Bigotry. And they had everybody in Oregon, it seemed like. I mean, they were an amazing array of people, ranging from clergy to mainstream politicians to very radical people of all faiths and all persuasions and all everything. And they got up there and they each made it was an under 30-second statement and very punchy. And
Whoa.
It was, and this was like the weekend before the election. And it was the most powerful rally I've ever been to. I thought this is the way to do it. So you can, but they were all talking about the same thing.
Right.
So you can do it that way. It was very well choreographed. Mm. But in lieu of that, I guess having a shorter list of people speaking a little bit longer works too. But it's something to throw out for future marches, especially when people are so fever pitched. I think they are now against the war. In fact, if we get really close to impeaching Bush, mm-hmm. I just would throw that out as an idea for a rally, because it was really powerful, because you see just the range of diversity that's supporting the cause, and that you can tie all these different issues together, but you have to have people to be disciplined. You can say 3 sentences.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk a bit about we're going to be a little longer than 3 sentences, but who's going to be speaking, what are the issues, and then where we're going to go from there.
Well, the overall theme for the rally in March is End the War, Begin the Peace, and it's on the anniversary of the third anniversary of the war in Iraq. There's 5 sub-themes. There's Bring All the Troops Home Now, No More Blood for Oil, which Iman will be addressing, among other speakers. Iman, who's visiting us from Iraq.
And who's going to be on in about 10 minutes. This is, her name is Iman Ahmed Kamas.
Yes.
And she will be on with us in about 10 minutes by phone.
Yeah, and there will also be, there's a slot for the Vets for Peace, the military families, and the Gold Star families. And I'm not sure exactly who's speaking for that, but they're also going to be speaking to bringing the troops home immediately because of their family.
So the personal side there.
Mm-hmm.
And besides, what else are we going to be addressing?
We're also going to be talking about ending the occupations of Iraq, Afghanistan, the West Bank, and Gaza. And so we'll have speakers to each of those issues.
Right.
And then we got two more sub-themes?
We got three more sub-themes. Fund education, healthcare, jobs, and the environment, not war. Respect human rights and international law. Stop the torturing and spying. And military recruiters out of our schools.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that covers it. I mean, that's the other thing that I get very excited about is when you can find it within it, bringing it in, as you're calling them now, the sub-themes. It's a new phrase to me. But I like it. But that they bring together all the threads of what is wrong with this war. But there's nothing about impeaching Bush, that you don't have that as one of the...
Not in this thread, but I would imagine we're going to see some signs to that effect.
Okay. Oh, yes.
Yeah. Actually, there was this great sign I saw in Latin America of Bush's face with a Hitler mustache. This is the week before the exchanges between Rumsfeld and Chavez's government about who is the worst Hitler. And so anyway, it was Bush with a little Hitler mustache, and then it said, Assassin. And just that. I mean, it didn't say anything except his face and assassin. And it was all over Caracas when I was there. And it was a very powerful, powerful image. I'm not sure if people are quite ready to show that image here. But I do think that that's the way he's perceived, not just in South America, but in Europe as well.
In most of the world, I think. Yeah.
So let's talk a bit about the logistics of the march, how people should get there. It's supposed to be sunny on Sunday. That was the forecast I saw last night. Bring your umbrella, though. But how should people get there, especially if we're hoping to have in excess of 10,000 people, which would be nice. I mean, what are your goals? Do you have a projection to how many people you hope are going to show up?
50,000.
Good.
I don't know. We're being really optimistic about, we're going to have thousands of people, and the next day the war is going to be over and we'll be done.
Well, at least as many people who went to the Kerry rally 2 years ago.
Oh,
I mean, all of those of you who went to hear John Kerry speak, there were 50,000 people there.
Yeah.
And there were 50,000 people, I think, protesting before the war started. So, need to be out there, folks.
Definitely. Well, what's really great this year is there are going to be a lot of kind of feeder marches. A lot of people are going to come as groups and join the park, join the rally in the park. So lots of the churches downtown, because it's a Sunday, after service, they're going to gather together and they're all going to walk as a group down to Waterfront Park. And that's going to be really amazing. There's a labor feeder march. There's a women's feeder march. We're meeting in the South Park blocks near the Art Museum, Southwest Madison and Park at 12:15. And we're going to have a little activity up there. And then we're all going to march together down to the park and have all the women arrive together. So a lot of people are doing things like that. You can kind of connect with whatever organizations you're involved in and see if there's a feeder march being planned around that. It's right there in Waterfront Park, just north of the Morrison Bridge. It's Sunday. Parking's free.
I would actually recommend people don't drive down there, especially with
the construction
going on.
People should definitely, grab the bus, grab the MAX.
Yeah. In fact, I think I'm going with a march from Irvington, or meeting some friends in Irvington, which is pretty far from where I live, but the attraction of the it'll be the MAX march.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think
that's great. Take the MAX over, fill it with marchers. The Vets for Peace are actually they have a new peace park on the East Bank, like near the Esplanade, this little piece of land that they're going to take over and make a peace memorial, and they're going to start at their park, and then they're going to march across the bridge. I think the Morrison Bridge is where their thing is. They're just going to march right across the Morrison Bridge and have a march at the park.
Last time I was at a big march, actually, I met my friends on the east. We met on the east approach to the Hawthorne Bridge, and I think that Peace Park is around Salmon, is right near, it's between Salmon and Madison. And I'm not sure which bridge they'll march over, but the gathering place is right around Salmon Street, right by the Esplanade. And it's... either Hawthorne or Morrison is a good place to march across. Though I'd say with the construction that's going on right now that...
It's a little difficult to get into the park, but the Esplanade along the west side is open. So if you want to, get to the waterfront from any street and then just walk up the Esplanade, you can get to it that way too.
So, idea, bring your own feeder march. And
definitely.
Keep the energy going. And... on the way there, and hopefully probably on the way back, too.
Mm-hmm.
So then the march is going to leave at 2:30 from
the march is
the north end of Waterfront Park.
It's going to go up Pine Street, because that's the biggest open area, and it's going to do kind of go above Burnside and then loop back down and come up from the south and back into the park, so that we're going to do that thing so that it crosses itself by a few blocks, so you can look through the buildings and see the march going on the other side and just see how many people there are. And we're also, they've got a long stretch going down Broadway, so we can get a photograph. They're going to post somebody on a ladder and get one of those photographs of the march, like, all piled up down the street. So it's going to be really amazing.
Sounds great.
And again, for people who don't want to march, there's going to be music, there's tabling, so you can just hang out at the rally site, and there'll be things to do there as well.
But it sounds like the march is going to be less than a mile in length if we're just going through. It won't be a big march.
No.
Won't be like the one we did in Caracas. I think it was about a 5 mile march.
Oh my God.
Well, we've got a caller, and if you want to join in the conversation, you can give a call at 503-231-8187. I'm talking with Kelly Campbell, who is with the American Friends Service Committee, and Katie Heald, who is with Code Pink Portland. We might talk a bit more about your organization in a little while, too. And very shortly, we're going to be joined by Iman Ahmad Kamas, who's an Iraqi journalist who's traveling around the United States and is going to be at the march speaking on Sunday. But also want to hear from you at 503-231-8187. Hello, you're on the air. Well, we had a caller, so we thought. Let's see if we can find this caller. Hello, you're on the air. Okay, I guess we lost the caller. So do call back. I think there was a question about the Veterans Freedom March. Or an answer. I'm not sure which. Well, it's about 2 minutes before 8 o'clock. You are listening to KBOO Portland, listener-sponsored community radio at 90.7 in the Portland metro area, 91.9 in the Columbia River Gorge, and 100.7 in the Mid-Willamette Valley. And we're talking today about the upcoming march and rally for peace and to end the Iraqi war. And again, I'm joined by Kelly Campbell with American Friends Service Committee and Katie Heald, who is with Code Pink Portland. So let's, actually, I'm kind of interested in some of the other events that are going to be happening leading up to the march and building the momentum for the big march.
There is a lot going on. Tonight there's a singing, a peace song sing-along. We're all getting together to have a bunch of people learn some of the peace songs that are, you know, really easy for large groups to sing, so that on Sunday we can get the whole crowd to join in singing songs together, to kind of bring everyone's energy together instead of just watching people sing. Do you have the calendar in front of you?
I do. There's actually today at noon, the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom is doing their weekly vigil from 12 to 1 at Pioneer Courthouse Square. So if you're downtown, take your lunch break and go out and show some support. And then tomorrow night, there's going to be the sing-along practice at St. Luke's Lutheran Church. There's also going to be at First Unitarian Church a reflective peace offering, the Heart of Peace, that's being put together by Living Earth Gatherings. On Friday, there's going to be lobbying. We're going to be visiting each of the congressional delegations in Oregon, so
including there's a meeting with Walden's office in Bend. There's a group in Eugene going to meet DeFazio's office. So all over the state, people are going in.
And then if you can't get enough of your marching or need a little marching practice, Friday night, 5 p.m. at Pioneer Courthouse Square, it's the weekly Portland Peaceful Response Coalition March. These guys have been marching since the invasion of Afghanistan every week.
Yeah, they've been marching for 5 years.
And they usually have the drum corps out there. Yep. And that would be actually a great time to go through downtown Portland, be handing out flyers, getting people who haven't heard about the march on Sunday excited about joining us. On Saturday, there's the second annual Veg Fest, which is a compassionate living fair.
Lots of free vegetarian food.
As opposed to vegging out.
First Unitarian.
Yes. Don't veg out the Veg Fest.
You're going to need all your vegetables so you can march the next day.
Exactly.
And then Sunday is the big march again, gathering at 1:30 at Waterfront Park. Rally starts at 2, marching at 2:30. Lots of feeder marches. Following on Monday, there's going to be a group of folks visiting Wyden's office and potential civil resistance action. They'll be asking Wyden to do his part to stop the war in Iraq. So there's going to be a gathering and press conference outside that we're asking folks to come down to, and maybe Katie can explain.
Yeah, there's going to be a press conference and a support vigil outside the federal building from 12 to 1. And Iman is also going to be in that press conference, a lot of clergy people, a veteran for peace. So there are going to be a lot of people speaking to the press specifically about what Senator Wyden needs to do and why he hasn't introduced legislation and how he needs, because there's nothing in the Senate right now. There's no anti-war legislation on the floor of the Senate. So we're convincing Wyden, especially since he just came back from Iraq, that he really needs to introduce something so that there can be an actual debate on the issue in the Senate. And so a group of people is going to be going inside to speak with the office and really make it clear that this is our demand. But we really need people. It's a completely permitted legal march outside to come and vigil and show support for the fact that Senator Wyden needs to listen to us. And also phone banking, if you can get to a phone at between 11:45 and 12:30 and call Wyden's office and just say, the people who are in your office right now, you need to listen to them because they are speaking for me. If we can flood their phones with calls, maybe he will actually listen and introduce some legislation.
And this is on Monday.
This is on Monday afternoon.
So if between 11:30 and...
And 12:30.
12:30. Call Wyden's office.
Call Wyden's office.
Listen to the people
Portland
in your office. Okay.
Yeah.
We've got, I think that Iman is actually on the phone with us.
Oh,
but
great.
Before we get her to talk with her, we also have the vet from Peace, vet for Peace back.
Uh-huh.
I want to just put him on quickly. So,
great.
Hello, you're on the air. Hello, you're on the air. Let's see what's happening. We have a lot of strange sounds, but no person. Okay, well, maybe we'll let go of this and we will bring up Iman. So, is Iman there? Having a little trouble with our phones today, it seems like. Okay, let's see if we can get a man going. Okay.
Tapping the phone.
Okay,
oh,
well,
no.
we'll talk amongst ourselves until we get Iman back up there.
The one event we didn't get to on the calendar mm-hmm. is Monday night, Iman speaking. And since she's only speaking for a couple minutes at the rally, we're really encouraging people to come out Monday night at First Unitarian Church, the Salmon Street Sanctuary, which is at 12th and Salmon downtown. Mm-hmm. And she's going to be speaking from 7 to 8:30. She's got a slideshow of photographs from Iraq. She's a journalist, a translator, a mother, an activist who's come from Baghdad to the U.S. to talk about what's going on there, to give us her perspective, to allow us to ask questions of an Iraqi woman who's experiencing this war every single day. And I think it's really important that we come out to show our support for her, to listen to her voices, and to get some of our questions answered about what's really going on. So we're lucky to have her here. We're going to be raising money that night that will go to her and the other Iraqi women who have traveled to the U.S. so courageously. So that'll be funding their transportation here, as well as giving them some money to go back and continue their courageous work in Iraq. So hoping that folks will come out for this very special event Monday night.
She's part of a group of Iraqi women who are touring the United States right now. I know that she's calling us from Connecticut. So.
Yes, Code Pink managed to bring a delegation of women from Iraq. They had to risk their lives to go to Jordan to get visas because you can't. Iraqis are not being issued visas in Baghdad. So they had to travel to Amman to get visas and in order to get over here. The costs were just astronomical, but Code Pink managed to make this happen so that we could hear the voices of these Iraqi women instead of hearing the voices of people like Senator Wyden, you know, white men going over there. Oh, I'm going to tell you what's happening in Iraq. We need to really listen to the people who actually live there and honor what they want us to do with their country. So it was a very important undertaking that Code Pink just, you know, decided to do this and bring these women here. And one woman is touring through the South right now. She's in Alabama. Iman is going to be coming over and doing the West Coast. So there's a whole bunch of visits going on around the country. And you can see their whole schedule at globalexchange.org.
Right, which includes this show. And I'm hoping that we can work through these technical difficulties. I know that Iman is waiting to get on the air here, but I'm watching. Okay, so we're going to try again. So good morning, Iman. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Good morning.
Fantastic. We've been having some technical difficulty, so we were just kind of killing time until we got you up here.
No problem.
We are having some more technical difficulty because Kelly can't hear you right now, so I think my engineer is going to have to get in here and make sure that everybody is able to hear what's going on.
Okay.
So in the meantime, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and why you are in the United States?
My name is Iman Khamas, and I live in Iraq, in Baghdad, all my life. And I am married. I have family. I have daughters. I am here to tell the American people what is really going on in Iraq right now and for the last 3 years, what kind of destruction the Iraqi country, society, nation, state, infrastructure, what kind of destruction they experienced, what kind of killings, detainees, missing, etc. So I want to inform, to educate the American people that this is what's really happening in Iraq. It's not about liberation. It's not about democracy and freedom. It's about occupation.
Okay. Actually, I'm gonna throw this over to you, Katie, for a second, since you can hear. Mm-hmm. I need to make sure that we get some.
So is it okay, the sound now?
Kelly is not hearing.
You don't hear.
Yeah, I'm hearing you fine.
Two of us can hear you. But
yeah, so we're going to carry, and I'm going to try to see what I can do to get mm-hmm. Kelly. So, Katie, I would like you to talk to Iman for a second while I go and see what's going on here.
All right. Well, Iman, can you just tell us a little bit about what the situation is like in Iraq, and especially for women, since you're here with Code Pink and with that delegation?
Yeah, I can tell you many things about what's going on in Iraq. Mm-hmm. The situation is very bad, as you can imagine, and it is getting worse day by day. Every day, always, yesterday is more beautiful, better than today. Things are really getting very worse, and the most dangerous thing is the security issue. We don't feel secure even inside our houses, even inside our bedrooms. Of course, you can imagine going out is very dangerous. Mm-hmm. Not only for women, also for men, for families, for everyone. Mm-hmm. The bombing, the car bombs, the random shooting by the American troops or the Iraqi troops. The gangs. The security situation is very, very bad. And life in general is very extremely difficult. Mm-hmm. Daily life, I mean, the economy is simply wreck, and unemployment is unimaginable. So, yeah, the situation is really very bad.
Because, I mean, one of the generals just stood up the other day and said that, things are getting better. It's not great, but things are getting better, and everybody's going to school, and it's great. So
I know who you are talking about. Mm-hmm. You mean General Pace?
Right.
But yesterday I read it in one of the, I think it was The Sun, mm-hmm. one of the newspapers, what he said. He changed his mind yesterday, and I read that he said that things are really dangerous now, and that this is a turning point in the history of Iraq. Mm-hmm. So either the Iraqis choose to live happily and without any kind of armed conflict, or they descend into civil war, as if it is like a choice.
Right.
I am going to fight, or I'm going to be peaceful. Things are not like that, not so simple.
Right. I mean, where does the armed conflict of the American soldiers come into that?
Yeah.
Well, actually, let's talk about some of the reasons why the conditions in Iraq are just so difficult. I mean, what is your daily life like at this point, and how is that impacted every day by the kind of warfare that's going on?
Why is it difficult? Because it is not secure. Because many people are unemployed. Because the prices are high. Because killings are going on. Because tens of thousands of Iraqis are being detained in prisons without any kind of process. They are detained and put there, and they have to wait for months or years for their files to be processed, and so that they can, be released, and the Americans tell them that your file is clean, you can go now. They are just arrested under suspicion. We are not okay because hundreds of thousands of Iraqis are killed, and the killing is going on, and more than 50% of these killings are civilians and women and children. Women and children, because the rest are civilian, but I'm talking about women and children. It is very bad because we don't know what's going to happen in the next minute, in the next day. We don't have any kind of vision for the future. We simply live to survive. You understand? Mm. We just live to survive. To survive our day. To protect ourselves and our loved ones. That's all. And we're not doing much about that because people are getting killed daily, as you can see in the news.
Now, we get the propaganda here in this country that we went to war in Iraq to bring freedom and democracy to Iraq, and that things are horrible under Saddam, and now they're going to be better under the democratic government that's being installed, theoretically, by the United States. Do you feel that if you were going to compare your life now with your life before the U.S. invasion, how would you compare the differences?
It is worse now. When I say it is worse now, I don't mean that in the past it was wonderful, it was happy. No, it was not. It was very difficult in the past. You remember we had 13 years of sanctions, which was the cruelest crime to be committed against the Iraqi people. It was a slow death, you know. You understand? And we had the 1991 war, which devastated Iraq, which destroyed everything in Iraq, you know, 1991. Mm-hmm. We had before that the Iranian war. It was not happy. It was not good. But as bad as it was, now it is worse. And if you go now to any city of Iraq, any street, if you ask any person, you know, just anyone in the street, how is it now? Is it better or in the past was better? He would definitely say no. Now it is worse. In every aspect, in every sense of the meaning. So I don't know. I mean, I keep on thinking of one positive thing about this occupation, just one thing I cannot find. And I move around, I meet families, I go to cities. I don't find any positive point about this occupation.
Mm. So what kind of organizing are you doing in Iraq right now to end the occupation? And because it sounds like so much of your life is just taken up with survival. So
what I do in Iraq actually for the last year and a half is help families in the refugee camps and the homeless families. Especially in the areas where there is bombing, because when a city is attacked, the families run away and they live in refugee camps, in tents, they live in destroyed buildings, they live in with relatives, and always these families live in difficult conditions, sometimes inhuman conditions. So these families need everything, from food to medicine to clothes to blankets, especially when it is in the middle of the desert and it's very cold. They need medicines, they need heaters, this kind. So we collect whatever we can, and we go there and, you know, try to help these families. That's what I do.
Now, is there any kind of help at all from the supposed government of Iraq? Is there enough of a functioning government that it can actually provide services for the population?
The government neglects these areas totally because they consider them, and also the occupation authorities, they consider these areas hosting terrorists. Mm. So these areas are totally neglected. For example, in Al Qa'im, which is a city more than 400 kilometers west of Baghdad, the hospital, the general hospital in the city, which covers a very big area in the desert, all the villages, all the small towns around, was bombed and was destroyed, totally destroyed by the American troops. Of course, they came later and they apologized. They said, we were mistaken. We thought that there are insurgency here. But the thing is that the hospital was destroyed. So when we went there and we asked the director of the hospital, what kind of help you need? And he said, he gave me lists and lists of help that will you know, cost billions of dollars. Of course, I mean, I cannot do anything about it. I can help with some medicines, with some antibiotics, with some, you know, small, you know, like surgery tools. But I cannot help, you know. It is beyond our capacity. Anyway, so I asked him, why don't you write to the Ministry of Health? where is the Ministry of Health? He said, no one came from the ministry even to ask if we need anything. And all the reports, all the documents that we send to the Ministry of Health were unreplied. And we are now totally dependent on whatever help any organization can send us, because they are in desperate situation. So the government does not help these areas because they consider them host terrorists, and also the Americans do not help in these areas. And even in other areas, actually, the situation in, for example, in the south, which is, I mean, relatively speaking, is quieter, more calm than these, what they call hot spots. Even there, the situation is miserable. So this is the situation, and but we do we do get some help from international organizations. You know, they send us medicines, they send us, and whatever we get, we take very quickly to the hospitals and to the clinics, etc.
Well, I'm really interested in trying to help to paint a picture for listeners who, particularly most Americans, who've never lived under the conditions of war. So I'm not sure that it's easy for American audiences to even conceive of the conditions that you're experiencing in Iraq. But talk about the how much of electricity do you have? How much don't you have? What is it like? What's the transportation like? I mean, how easy is it to get around town, let alone from one town to another town? And what kind of infrastructures remain after all the incessant bombing attacks of the United States?
And what does a curfew mean? I mean, even the military mentions that there's a curfew in Baghdad, but what does that mean? Because we don't have that here in the United States.
Just a minute. You have asked many questions.
Yeah.
And each one, if I want to answer each one, I will take the whole day. Well, you first asked about electricity. We have, in my house, I live in the middle of Baghdad, we have 1 hour a day of electricity. I mean, this is when I left Baghdad. Because before that, for example, we had something like 4 hours, the electricity is cut, and then we get it for 1 hour. And, you know, this is the schedule. But before I left, things were very, very bad. So we had something like 1 hour a day. This is as far as electricity in my area where I live is concerned. Because, for example, in the south, the situation is rather better. Public transportation we don't have now at all. We have to move by taxis. Again, taxis is very difficult because of the fuel problem, crisis actually, not a problem. I think the most hurt people by this is, fuel crisis are the taxi drivers, because these people, you know, they have families to support, and when the gasoline the price is doubled like 50 times, they cannot afford to work anymore in the streets. And you can see at the fuel stations kilometers and miles of queues, people waiting for 2 days, for example, to get some gasoline to fill their cars. Transportation is very difficult. But this is not the only problem as far as transportation is concerned. The second, the main problem is that the blocks in the streets, all Baghdad streets now, all of them, are either completely closed, blocked, you cannot go through them, or they are partly closed, so that, for example, if you have a street with four lanes or three, two of them are blocked and one is available. And you can imagine the horrible traffic problem every day from the morning till afternoon.
So why are the streets blocked?
Why the streets are blocked?
Yeah.
Well, either because there is a military office there, American military office there, or either it is near the green zone, because you are not allowed to approach the green zone, or either there is an Iraqi police station, again, the street is blocked, cars cannot approach, even people walking on feet. And or there is a kind of hotel, a big hotel that foreigners are living there. All the ministries, all the government facilities are all of them surrounded by blocks, and the roads that go to these places are cut. When there is, for example, a meeting in the National Assembly or in the Green Zone, the bridges of Baghdad are blocked. No one can go there and no one can come from there. We have to, for example, I take a taxi to the nearest bridge and then I go out of the taxi. I cross the bridge on feet, if possible, because sometimes even on feet is not. And I go there and I walk for a while until I go, you know, far away from the meeting place, and from there I get a taxi. I'll tell you about an example which happened lately, which I put it on the internet. There was a meeting at 11 o'clock in a human rights organization, and I left at 8 in the morning, and I reached the place, which normally takes me 1 hour because it's outside Baghdad. I arrived the place at after 1 p.m. So, of course, the meeting was, you know, ending. But then I explained to them, I'm sorry, this is what happened. And I spent the whole day on the road, trying to reach from point to point to get to the meeting. And you can imagine if there is an emergency case, if there is an ill person, if there is a woman who is, you know, giving birth to a baby. You can imagine how difficult it is to arrive wherever you want to arrive. And sometimes when a car bomb or an explosion happen in a certain place of Baghdad, again all the roads are blocked because, you know, the police are there and the ambulances and the things. It is very difficult. It is horrible, actually. And I don't know how until now Iraqis are, you know, apparently Iraqis are very strong people, so that they can be patient enough to survive in this atmosphere.
Well, Katie also asked you about the curfews and how that impinges on your freedom of travel.
The curfew, we have at night, we have curfew, but actually the curfew begins at 11, for example, but actually people after sunset, when it begins to get dark, people do not go out of their houses unless it is a very, very extremely urgent need. Otherwise, they don't move. They don't, because it's insecure, because there is fighting, shooting, random shooting, gangs, thieves, etc. So, no, people do not go out. The curfew, of course, you are not supposed to move around. In Baghdad City now, even it is in the morning or in the afternoon, there are many checkpoints. They search the car, they check your IDs, etc. And it happened many times that people who are moving to a hospital, they were shot or they were arrested. It depends on the situation at the point.
So under these conditions, how are you organizing, and what are your, I mean, I understand that the goal is to get the United States out of Iraq, but how do you see going about achieving that goal?
You mean me personally?
Well,
or in general?
What I know it's not just you. I mean, the people that you're working with and other groups, I mean, I'm assuming that there are other people organized around the country who are trying to stop the U.S. occupation. So I'm just trying to understand how, under the conditions you're describing, people can actually organize. You describe going to a meeting and getting there hours late. So
yes.
How do people organize?
Yes. As far as I am concerned, I am not involved in any political party or group or anything. As I told you, we are a group of women who are helping the refugees, especially families, women and children. But for other groups to work, political parties or groups or individuals, they have to, you know, to be very careful. They have to, many meetings are held outside Iraq, not in Baghdad, because again, it's very risky and dangerous. And it is very difficult, but people have to work, you know, have to do something about it. So they risk their lives, and many of them get killed, and whether assassinated, shot, explosion, many of them get killed, but they have to their work, to do it. They have to go to meet, so they do it. They risk their lives.
Well, I mean, it seems particularly frustrating to think, like, for instance, with the four Christian peacemaking team people, and then that Tom Fox was found dead recently, and people who are going to help the people of Iraq, and they're being targeted by some of the groups that are doing kidnapping. So do you feel like there's a possibility that there'll be some way to achieve peace in Iraq in the near future?
I don't see any kind of light in this direction. I know Tom and I know CPT, and they were doing a wonderful job in Iraq. Actually, before I came here to the U.S., we managed, myself and CPT, a group of women in CPT, we managed to release two Iraqi women from an Iraqi police station. They were arrested for something like a week, and we managed to get them out of prison, and we were very happy about that. The CPT did a very wonderful job about the detainees. They helped many Iraqis, but they risked their lives, of course. And this is what happened to Tom. I'm sorry we lost Tom, and I'm sorry that these people cannot, because I heard that CPT are leaving Iraq now. They decided to leave, understandably enough, of course. I mean, they are targeted. I think that the occupation is responsible for all these people who are killed. Because first, not only the foreigners, also the Iraqis, by the way, because the occupation is according to the international law, according to Geneva conventions, they are responsible 100% for the security of the people in the occupied country. Mm-hmm. And also it is the responsibility of the Iraqi government, as far as they are, you know, they consider themselves the authority in Iraq now, they are responsible for these victims, for the lives of these victims, and they have to do something about it. We don't know who kidnapped Tom. We don't know who killed him. We don't know how he was killed. I feel very sad to talk about Tom and other CPTers, because they are really very wonderful people, and other organizations. But the thing is that foreign journalists and foreign activists are not, you know, in Iraq, people look upon them with suspicion because they don't know why these people are there, what they are doing in Iraq, unless they are really tested, you know. And again, I mean, CPT are working in Iraq for more than 3 years, actually even before the war, and they are very well tested by Iraqis. And I mean, so I think that it is the occupation authorities who are very and the Iraqi authorities who are responsible for the safety of the Iraqis and the foreigners.
I just wanted to ask you, man. I mean, if I was in the situation that you're in Iraq, I would really be angry at the entire United States and everyone in it for what they're doing to my country. And
we are angry.
I wondered what do the Iraqi people feel about the people of the United States and just the whole situation in the whole country?
The Iraqi people are intelligent, and they are highly educated, and they know very well that the American government is something, and the American people something else. And you hear that from many people. I mean, wherever you go, they say that, no, we know that the American people is something else. But to tell you the truth, after Bush was reelected for the second term, I mean, people began, when you tell them that, well, listen, this is the American government, the American people are different, they say then how they elected Bush for a second term, and they know what happened in Iraq in them. The war is going on, and the occupation is going on, and the killing is going on. So how did they elected him for a second term? It is becoming more difficult, you know, you understand?
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah, Iraqis do differentiate between a government and a people.
Yeah, I was actually talking with a man in Venezuela last month who was saying that he thought that the Venezuelans are far more fortunate than the Americans in terms of being informed. I wonder if you find this is true for Iraqis too, that perhaps Iraqis have more access to a variety of news sources than Americans have. And I mean, this Venezuelan man was saying, well, Americans basically, you know, listen to Fox TV, and that's all they know. They just basically know government propaganda.
Well, this is true. I mean, it's a pity because you have access to internet, you have access to satellite. It's not only Fox and CNN and the mainstream media. I mean, there are many alternative media that is going on. I have seen, I have met many journalists. Some of them are, you know, pro the government attitude or point of view. Some of them are not. But I think it's not impossible for the people to look for the truth, to look for the reality, and to work accordingly, to react accordingly. We in Iraq, actually, we don't have this kind of access because many of the, you know, many of the media sources are in English, and not many of them speak English, first of all, and second, because they don't have access to computers or internet, and even if they have, it is very difficult to, you know, to have electricity. So you see, I mean, it is limited. I think you have more access here.
Now, how about Al Jazeera? Is that a strong force?
It is working, but Al Jazeera's office in Baghdad is closed in Iraq. You know that. Mm-hmm. It was closed by the American authorities. Al Jazeera is not in Iraq now. They don't function in Iraq. The office is closed. So they just put the news that they have from other sources. They don't have direct access. So this is the situation. It is not now. I mean, more than 1 year that Al Jazeera was closed in Iraq. But Iraqis see Al Jazeera, and yeah, it is seen by many Iraqis.
I know that you are scheduled to be on the show for a half hour. I'm wondering if you want to stay around for a little bit longer. We're going to take some phone calls if you wanted to talk to some of our listeners.
Okay.
Okay, so we're going to take a phone call. So, and if you want to join the conversation and talk with Iman Ahmad Kamas, who's an Iraqi journalist and activist who's on the line. She's talking to us from Connecticut right now. Also in the studio, I have Kelly Campbell from American Friends Service Committee and Katie Heald, who is with Code Pink from Portland. And you can join the conversation by calling 503-231-8187. It's about 24 minutes before 9 o'clock here on KBOO. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, barely.
Oh, okay, yeah, bad connection. I just have a question for your guest. What does she expect to accomplish in this country if she's going on radio programs and going to marches and so forth, attended by your audience? Seems like she's speaking to the choir here. She needs to get her word out to people who aren't aware of all this stuff, because everybody that's listening is on her side anyway. You know, what does she want to do in this country?
Okay, do you have an answer for that?
Yes.
Okay. Iman?
Yes.
So did you hear the listener's question?
I heard the question, yes.
Okay, do you have a response?
I want to respond. I feel that it's my duty to tell the American people about what I am experiencing in Iraq as an Iraqi citizen, and what millions of other Iraqi people are experiencing like me. I mean, we are ordinary people. We have nothing to do with political parties, with authorities, with government, etc. And we are facing these difficulties and these risks and these dangers because of the occupation, because of this very deteriorating situation in Iraq. So I want to tell the American people that your troops came to Iraq, invaded Iraq, and your government said that it is for liberation, it is for women, it is for it is because Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, because you're linked to Al-Qaeda, and all these things turned out to be lies, turned out not to be true. Mm-hmm. So I want to tell the people here that listen, I mean, this is what you are doing to my country, and this is what's happening. This is how my country is destroyed and devastated. And, I mean, and I tell them what I know. And they act, you know, they or react as they feel, as they understand what's going on. Now, I do believe that the American people are the only side or the only part or the only one who can do something about Iraq, do something about the occupation of Iraq, because they can, you know, this is your government, this is your country, and you have your means to put pressure on the government to change its policy against Iraq. I don't think that other countries have the capacity to, you know, to affect or put impact on the American government. I think it's only the American people who have this ability or capacity. So that's why I am here. That's why I am talking. And I hope that I can convince some people to do something about this. And it is not only for the Iraqi people; it's also the American people. Mm-hmm. I mean, your sons and your daughters are there, and you are paying these billions of dollars. Why is that? I mean, and things are getting worse every day for you and for us. So why? Why to go on with this very cruel war in Iraq?
Well, actually, I think what the caller was asking was that you're talking to people that he thinks already agree with you, like assuming that all cable listeners are agreeing with the people sitting on the table, which I don't think is really true. Are you talking to other groups besides those who will be attending peace rallies and people who are already in the camp of wanting the United States out of Iraq?
Well, no, the audience is not all of them agree with me. Some of them do, actually many of them do, which is good. But many of them are, you know, they don't know. And at many times they come to me and they say, thank you for coming, thank you for giving us this information. And, you know, and sometimes they do not agree with me. And they argue and they, you know, we have conversations and I talk to them and, you know, at some point I found some people waiting for me and there was a meeting in a university, and when I went to the place, I found some organization which is pro-war, pro-occupation, which they think that it is, they do believe that it is good there, that the American troops there are doing a good job, etc. And they were holding signs and holding banners. And so I went to them, I said hello, and I have discussion with them. Of course, I listened to them first until they finished what they had to say, and I began to ask them questions, and they also asked me questions, and we have this kind of, you know, dialogue. Mm-hmm. So it is not, not all the time that the people agree with me on what I am saying, but I would say that, the majority of the people that I meet are compassionate, are understanding. But it happened many times that I don't have this kind of audience. Actually, even radio interviews, sometimes I get radio interviews or debates which are really aggressive and hostile, but I still say what I need to say, and the people, they either, you know, listen and respect what I'm saying, or they just make fun of me or laugh or, you know, being hostile. But, I mean, it happens, I'm meeting different kinds of people, yes.
Right. Well, I'm talking with Iman Ahmad Kamas, who's an Iraqi journalist and activist, and she's here in the United States educating Americans about what's really happening in Iraq, and she'll be speaking at the Great March and Rally this Sunday, March 19th, at Waterfront Park. And I also have with me in the studio Kelly Campbell with American Friends Service Committee and Katie Heald, who is with Code Pink Portland. We'll be hearing a little bit more from them, I think, in a moment as well. And also here to take your calls at 503-231-8187. Want to let you know that coming up at 9 o'clock on KBOO, it's Veterans Voice with Northwest Vets for Peace. At 10 o'clock on People Rise Up, Andrew Geller looks at the identification of enemies and scapegoats as a unifying principle. At 10:30, host Mel Resler speaks with George Eisman, an educator on vegetarian nutrition. And 11 o'clock on Democracy Now!, the former head of the Thomas Merton Center discusses newly released files showing the FBI has been monitoring and possibly infiltrating a Pittsburgh peace group. I think we left off the last thing there. Anyway, and again, if you want to join the conversation, give a call at 503-231-8187. It's about 19 minutes before 9 o'clock here on Locus Focus. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi.
Good morning.
Is that me?
Yeah, you're on the air.
Okay, thanks. Iman, first I would just like to thank you so much for committing your life to this work at this point in time. I have one issue and one question. First, I want you to know that it's very questionable that the American people actually elected George Bush in this last election. There's a lot of concern that it was actually stolen from the American people. But just so that you keep that in your hat, and I do have one real big concern. You know, I'm very much against the Americans having that we went into Iraq. But now that we're there, you know, there's people who say, well, if we leave, it will make things worse. And I would just like to hear what you have to say and your perspective about that.
Yes. Being there, I mean, for the American troops to be there is the main reason and the main...
Excuse me a second. I think we need to pot down the collar. We're getting this very strange feedback. Okay, so now you can continue. You no longer have the space aliens coming. Okay.
So is it okay now?
Yes, it's good now.
Okay. So for the American troops to be there is the reason of violence, first of all. And to say that we are going to leave and for the American government to decide to withdraw its troops when Iraq is going to be stable, this is a very twisted logic, because as far as the troops are there, the violence will go on because they are going to be targeted and they are going to bomb and kill. So this is one issue. The second thing is that they are not doing anything about the violence, and as you can see, things are going from bad to worse. Mm-hmm. And I have met many congressmen, many people in Washington, and I can feel that they don't know what to do. They are in a mess. So the thing is that, as we said, being there is the reason of the violence. And anyway, in the past, we didn't have this kind of sectarian violence and these risks of or threats of civil war. So I think what the American government can help to help the Iraqis to do is that they, first of all, they have to declare to announce the end of the occupation of Iraq and to put a date within months, not within years, a date for withdrawing the troops from Iraq. Second, to let the Iraqis who are not related to the occupation in any way, to let them work out a plan to, like an emergency government, like any kind of arrangement to run the country through these months, and also to give some room or some space to the international community, to the United Nations, to the Arab League, to anyone who is interested in helping getting Iraq out of this ditch. I think it is possible, but only on one condition, that the American government, let things be done and as we say, lift their hand from the issue. Otherwise, I mean, if they are going to be involved in anything, it's going to be suspicious, and it will not succeed.
Because, I mean, what they're telling us is is that you guys are just fighting yourselves, that Iraqis are fighting amongst each other, and that they'll keep doing that unless we stay here and make them stop. So is that not what's happening?
It is happening now. We are seeing the beginnings of these things.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't happen in the history of Iraq, all the history of Iraq. It didn't happen that Iraqis kill each other. Never. We marry each other. We live with each other. We are neighbors. We are relatives. You can find one tribe, half of it are Sunnis, the other half are Shia, etc. It never happened in the past. It began after the occupation. This kind of talk about Sunni, Shia, Kurd, Arab, etc. And it was encouraged, this kind of thinking, by the political procedures that were taken, you know, the mm-hmm. governing council, the constitution, the election, all of them were done according to the sectarian and ethnic divisions.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, we are at this point, and things are, you know, obviously are going out of the control of the American authorities and the Iraqi, by the way. The Iraqis are not controlling anything. Now we are at this point. I think now the American government has to declare, to announce that the occupation is going to end.
Mm-hmm.
Because in this case, you know, the resistance or the insurgency, they have no reason to fight, right?
Right.
I mean, this is one thing. They are going to, you know, to calm down the insurgency. Now, if there are any other armed men or fighters who are working for their own political agendas, who are not working like the militias, the political parties, the foreign fighters, if they are there, the terrorists, as you call them, these people, if they are keep on fighting, it means that they are not working for Iraq, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they are going to lose any kind of credibility, if they have any. So the first thing to do is that to announce that the occupation is going to be ended, and to schedule the withdrawal of the troops, and to let the Iraqis work out a plan with the help of the UN, the international community. Actually, the UN is working in Iraq, or was actually. And the Arab League tried to do something, but they were not succeeding because the occupation is there. And anything done under these circumstances is going to be suspicious.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be, you know, it doesn't have a credit. So it is very essential, it is very important that the American leave and decide to leave, and they make it known to the people, especially the people of Iraq, that they are going to leave.
We got a couple more callers who I think want to join in the conversation, so we're going to try to squeeze them in. We got about another 10 minutes here on Locus Focus. We're talking with Iman Ahmad Kamas, who is an Iraqi journalist and activist, and also you've been hearing Katie Heald asking some questions, which I really appreciate. She's my partner here today, Code Pink Portland, and the quiet Kelly Campbell, who we're going to hear a little bit more from at the end, because we got some more questions to talk about this upcoming march and rally. We're sort of focusing the show today around march and rally happening this Sunday, March 19th, to mark the third anniversary of the beginning of the war in Iraq.
And really quickly, if you want more information, the best place to get it is pprc-news.org. That's Portland Peaceful Response Coalition's website.
And we're going to try to squeeze a couple callers in here. And I want to thank Iman for taking time out to join us and staying a little longer than I think she was intending. But let's see if we've got a couple more people who want to talk with you. So hello, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Great show. I'll make my points very quickly, and then I'll ask my question, and then I'll leave so other people can have a chance. We know the U.S. military is targeting journalists in Iraq. That's been admitted by the Pentagon. We've seen that with the attempted murder, and evidence shows it was attempted murder of the Italian journalist, the lady, her name slips my mind, a few years ago at a roadblock. Do you remember that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Also as well, British SAS forces, mainstream news, have been caught dressed up like Arabs attacking British forces in Basra. I believe this was about 2 years ago as well. The London Guardian picked it up, and it made the mainstream news, at least in Europe, or in England, rather. Now, my question is this. The Christian relief worker, Fox, that was recently murdered, It seems to me a black ops operation, and I say that because, like you had stated earlier, the Iraqis were not fighting amongst each other, which we see the fighting amongst each other now. That's the argument that we hear all the time from our military and our Pentagon and Bush and Cheney, is we've got to stay in there, we've got to keep order. But yet, this chaos continues. It makes no sense to me that a relief worker would be assassinated who was over there doing good, helping the Iraqi people, supposedly by a faction that wants the U.S. government out. It doesn't make any sense at all. So I wondered your thoughts on that, because I heard you talk about it earlier in the show, if that appears to be a black op operation, and by all accounts, that's what it looks to me. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for calling. Got a response, Iman?
Hello. Can you tell me what is the question exactly?
Okay, he was asking, he's suspicious that Tom Fox was killed not by an Iraqi group, but he's calling it a black ops operation, but basically... some military forces that are promoted either by the United States or England, that he doesn't believe that it would be Iraqis who would have actually committed that murder.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm not... I can just analyze as far as information I have. I know Tom personally, and I know CPT. As I said, I worked with them. And the CPT, I didn't work with Tom on a specific project. I know him, you know, in the CPT office, but I have worked with other CPTers, especially the women, on many projects, and we were doing very, very good job and helping the Iraqis. So I don't think I'm sure that the Iraqis would not target people like Tom, because they are working, they are helping them. But who killed? Who killed Tom and people like him then? Who kidnapped these kind of people who are helping the Iraqis? We have in Iraq now all kinds of intelligence, or of all kinds of people who are, you know, armed people. We have militias. We have strange people, strange troops doing strange things, because I have seen people who were slaughtered, who were, you know, slaughtered by a bayonet, and I have listened to their stories, people who are killed in this way, slaughtered. I have seen things, very, very horrible things. Now, who is doing these things? This is a very big question. But again, it is the American responsibility, mm-hmm. and it is the Iraqi government responsibility to find out who are doing these, who are the people who are doing these things, and to do something about it. Tom is a friend, and he is an individual. In other cases, I mean, he is one person, but of course he is very dear to us. In other cases, tens of people are killed, hundreds of people are killed, and we don't see any investigation. We don't see any results for this investigation. You remember the UN man, the UN DiMillo, when the UN office was targeted and he was killed with many other UN employees. Till this moment, we don't know who did it. Mm-hmm. We know that there was investigation. We know that the American authorities refused, and they did not allow the UN to publish the results of the investigation. Right. Many mosques are being bombed, and many politicians, I mean big names like what you, these people are being assassinated and killed. And when they are targeted and killed, civilians and other people are killed with them. Like, for example, what happened in Najaf in August 2003 when Al-Hakim was assassinated with 84 other Iraqis in a mosque. And this happened many, many, many times. There is no investigation, and if there is, we don't know the results. Right. So why is it the American troops are so paralyzed? And also the Iraqi, not only the Iraqi authorities and the American authorities. Why are they so paralyzed? Why they are so incapable of doing something about it? What is the problem?
Yeah, I think, I mean, even if we don't know for sure that the American troops, you know, that some American force killed Tom Fox, I mean, it's still, directly or indirectly, I think the U.S. military is responsible for his death.
they are directly responsible,
right,
because it is their responsibility according to the international law,
exactly,
according to the Geneva Conventions. It is the responsibility of the occupying troops to protect people in the occupied country.
Okay, Iman Ahmad Kamas, it was very good talking with you, and people will be able to hear you Sunday afternoon at Waterfront Park in downtown Portland, and then also Monday. We'll give a little bit more information before we go. We're just about out of time, and I really appreciate that you've spent so much time with us. And
thank
I look
you very
forward
much
to hearing you speak in person this weekend.
Okay.
Yes, thank we'll you see you soon, Iman.
Okay.
See you soon. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And so we still have Kelly and Katie here for a couple more minutes, and so I thought we should go over just a couple more details. We've got a caller, too. I just want to squeeze in real mm-hmm quickly if their caller's still hanging on. So, hello, you're on the air. That caller is still there. Let's see. Okay, we lost that caller. So anyway, so quickly, we've got another minute or so left. Tell us what we should be doing on Sunday and Monday.
We should come down to Waterfront Park at 1:30 near the north of the Morrison Bridge and join everybody and even join some feeder marches if you know the groups that you're involved in are doing those. And for all the details on the rally and on the groups that are organizing it and everything, you can check the PPRC website, pprc-news.org.
And Kelly, in 1 minute, standing on 1 foot, I just wanted to, we never really touched very much about the military families, the Gold Star families, the 9/11 families. So talk a little bit about what role they're going to be playing in the march on and rally on Sunday.
Well, there is going to be a speaker from the Military Families Speak Out organization here in Oregon, which we're lucky to have, not lucky, but we're lucky to have so many military families that are standing up and speaking out against this war here in Oregon, so it's good to come out and support them. They're going to have a table, and they're going to have a speaker at the rally, as well as Iman, who we just heard, will be speaking at the rally. And Iman will also be speaking Monday night from 7 to 8:30 at the First Unitarian Church, Salmon Street Sanctuary. And she talked a little bit about the work she's doing in Iraq. I want people to know this Monday night event is free, but we are going to be raising money that will be going towards Iman, towards the other Iraqi women who are touring to support their work in Iraq. So it's a very important cause for folks to come out.
And people should also be at Ron Wyden's office?
Be in front of Ron Wyden's office from 12 to 1 on Monday. It's at the Federal Building now. He moved into the Federal Building at 3rd and Madison. And if you can't be there, then call his office between 11:30 and 12:30 and tell him to introduce legislation to stop the war. And you can also get more information on the Code Pink website, codepinkportland.org.
Well, I want to thank Katie Heald and Kelly Campbell for joining me. We'll see you all Sunday at Waterfront Park.
See you there.
Stay tuned for the Vets for Peace. They're on next, and we're going to go out with a little bit of music by Hugh Masekela.
All right.
KBOO Portland, and it's time now for Veterans Voice. They're going to be taking your calls today, so we'll get ready for that. At 10 o'clock on People Rise Up, Andrew Geller continues, It's Happening Here, his year-long series on fascism in the United States with a look at identification of enemies and scapegoats. Where am I? As a unifying principle. At 10:30, host Mel Resler speaks with George Eisman, an educator on vegetarian nutrition. His books include The Most Noble Diet and A Basic Course in Vegetarian and Vegan Nutrition. And at 11 o'clock on Democracy Now!, the former head of the Thomas Merton Center discusses newly released files showing the FBI has been monitoring and possibly infiltrating a Pittsburgh peace group because of its opposition to the war in Iraq. And it's Sunshine Week, when media around the nation raids public awareness about the importance of an open government. Now we're going to go right to Veterans Voice with Marvin, Bill, and JT.